Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com.
Joining me today, all the way from the other side of the world and very many time zones away in Brisbane, Australia, is writer Angela Slatter, who has previously won multiple Aurealis Awards, the British Fantasy Award, and has been a finalist for the World Fantasy Award twice. Her latest work is the novella Of Sorrows and Such, published by Tor.com, and it's about a witch living a quiet life in a little town until one day things are really not so quiet anymore. Angela, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I was telling you earlier, I really enjoyed Of Sorrow and Such. I love the witchcraft, I love the witches, I love the lack of fear most of the women have of the darkness that's, you know, part of their lives, part of everyone's lives. I love the women, all the women. Patience, the protagonist of the novella, has appeared in your work before, in earlier stories, I believe. Will you tell us a little bit about where this particular story came from?
I had written in a collection called Sourdough and Other Stories about her as a young woman and coming into her power as a witch. And I'd also finished that book with a story where she was an older woman, and I'd always wanted to revisit her because she is one of my favourite characters. She's quite fearless and she's very resourceful and she's also extremely ruthless. Someone had asked me to write a novella, and I just started thinking a bit more about Patience and what she might have done in her middle years and how she might have been, you know, trying to atone for some of the things she did in her early life. I had also had an idea that's been rattling around in my head for many, many years, probably 40 years, which is comes from an old, Appalachian tale about witches turning into cats and trying to frighten people away from certain places. So I finally got a chance to use that in this story.
I loved that Patience was neither the maiden nor the crone, both being sort of, you know, the more common iterations of witches that we see in pop culture. She's this practical solid in between. I love her determination, and I love, as I was saying earlier as well, that she's not good in the usual way. She wants what's best for her kind, for her loved ones, but she's going to do what it takes. And I mean, whatever it takes, you know, whether it be, let's not say what it might be, but, you know, all sorts of things that we might consider bad. This version, was this the first version you created? Is this how she came to you?
Pretty much. I mean, she, even when she was a young witch, she did the things that she absolutely had to do to survive. It's an idea I've always been fascinated by, that, you know, the idea of the traditional good woman or even the good witch will get punished because they're so good they won't do the bad things to survive. And I thought, well, you know, no one's that black and white. Why don't I have this person who is who has power and is not afraid to use it, who will be, you know, quiet and, as you said, you know, living a quiet life until something happens and she has to survive it. So that was how Patience kind of came about. And I had a lot of fun with the kind of challenges I might throw at her and the things that she might do in order to overcome them.
It's also interesting that while this story fits in with the other stories of Patience that you've written, I, for example, had not read the other stories, but it made no difference to me. This read very well as a whole. Did you, obviously, I'm guessing for people who have read the others, they can make more connections than, say, I could?
Probably, very probably. But I was really, really conscious when I wrote it that there would be a lot of people who hadn't read these Sourdough stories and so weren't quite aware of her backstory. So I had to tread a very fine line as to what I explained and what I exposed about her without over-explaining and making it sound like I was doing a summary of previous stories. So when I gave it to my beta readers, I said, you know, I don't want to direct you what to do, but this is the one thing I'm quite concerned about. So can you read this and tell me if it stands alone? So, and they pretty much said that I had done that. So I was really pleased that I had managed it. I think if you read the other Sourdough stories, you can have a rich experience of going aha. But you can absolutely read Of Sorrow and Such on its own and still enjoy it.
And I did.
Excellent.
Tell me about your interest in witches, in witchcraft. Did that start when you were younger, and was it formed by the stories you read, the fairy tales, for example, as a child?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, there are always witches in the fairy tales, and I am also a huge fan of history and literature, and a lot of historical literature deals with witches and witchcraft trials and how certain women were perfect victims for witch hunters. You know, all they had to be was old and alone and have a couple of warts and have a cat. And right. That was pretty much it. It's not really much, unwanted. you know, and they'd dunk them. They'd put them in these witch stools and then try and dunk them into a pond. And if they somehow survived, they were witches. And if they drowned, they were not. So... And I don't really think that's a win-win situation for anyone. But I remember reading fairy tales, and you start off and your concepts of good and evil are very black and white when you're reading that sort of thing. But I think the more I read, I started to think, well, I don't actually think, you know, the 13th fairy from Sleeping Beauty was wrong to be annoyed at being left right. out of the feast, you know. So she might have overreacted a little, but...
But hey, you know, she's a fairy. I mean, they're meant to be dramatic, right?
So, absolutely. So that was something I you know, started to think about a lot was, you know, these women aren't black and white.
I read an interview conducted with you from a couple of years ago online just last night, where you talked about how important it was to give agency back to the female characters from fairy tales, how post Grimm the fairy tale women were sort of reduced to these damsels in distress, something they hadn't been before. Will you tell me a little bit more about this process, please?
Yeah, when I was studying for my MA, I was reading an article about how the Grimms collected their stories by talking to women, basically, and one of them married a woman called Dortchen Wild, who was one of his main sources for these stories. And when they first collected them, they just put them down. They wrote them straight down. But over, I think it's something like a period of 7 years, there were like, 11 editions of the Grimm's fairy tales, and each time they got edited differently, and the voice of the female characters was edited out and taken away until, you know, in the later editions, the characters who spoke most were the bold young boys and the wicked women. So that's you know, again, quite judgmental, but it's a slow kind of a process when you find you have these tales that can be used to teach and indoctrinate. And I think that it became something that they could teach, you know, like The Good Girl's Guide to Behavior. I wrote an article a while ago called How to Be a Chosen Girl. And again, that's based on a lot of my study. And, you know, essentially you just had to have golden hair, be available, and you might get picked by the prince. So it was, again, it was a really short list of things. And be very passive, you know, don't try and rescue yourself. Wait for someone else to come and climb the tower and rescue you.
Not very far from what you need to be considered a witch, really. Just the, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes.
I mean, either you were old and warty and passive, or you were young and pretty and passive, but, you know, either way. So it was, It's kind of funny because it's either or, right? Either you get to be that princess or you get to be the witch. Where's the in-between?
That's it. And there are rules that you actually can't control. And I think that's the whole point. You know, you don't get much of a say in this. You're damned if you do, or you're damned if you don't.
Now, you have many degrees, I noticed, a PhD even, in creative writing. In what ways did your academic background help you with your writing, with your fiction? Was there ever a time when you were writing the stories that you do write, you know, during your degrees perhaps? And, you know, was your choice of genre ever questioned? Were you ever told, you know, that you're slumming it, as sometimes people who write genre fiction are told, unfortunately?
I don't think I was ever told that, because I don't think anyone would be brave enough to say that to my face. But you definitely, as a genre person, you know, people will sort of go, oh, it's speculative fiction, or oh, it's fairy tales, and you're kind of trying to point out that you there is a very long history attached to this, you know, and Angela Carter and A.S. Byatt have written in this, and they are extremely literary authors. So, you know, it is one of my bugbears, but it never stopped me writing what I loved, because when I first started my my master's, I had been thinking about doing chick lit. So,
which is not given enough credit, I always feel.
Absolutely, it's not, you know, but there's the whole thing about women's writing is not taken seriously, you know, and no one refers to guy lit, you know, that's just literature, or proper fiction. So it is. It's one of those things that's just sort of looked down on. But I love writing, and I love what I write, and I always do my level best to make sure that not only is the story engaging, but that the language is elegant, and that the writing is elegant. And no one can ever sort of say, oh, you know, that she's not a good craftsperson, you know, because that crafting is really important to me.
Do you have a preference for form in terms of writing? Do you like doing the short stories? I know you have, this is a novella, of course. I know you have another novella coming out with Tora.com, and I believe you have a full-length novel as well. So do you have a preference between them?
It's been really difficult because I started out with short stories and I love them. I love the form. I love the challenge of getting a fully formed tale into 3,000 words. So the big challenge for me over the last few years has been to extend to novel length works. And I think that's why I have enjoyed doing a couple of novellas so much, because I can use so many of the skills that I have with a short story, but, you know, just stretch and extend myself beyond that. I have enjoyed doing the novels, because I've got Vigil coming out next year with Joe Fletcher Books, which is an imprint of Hachette International, and I'm writing the sequel at the moment called Corpse Light, which is considerably easier because I know a lot more about planning and plotting than I did when I first wrote Vigil, because it started off as a short story and three novellas, which I subsequently jammed together like Dr. Frankenstein, but still somehow it has come out okay. I really do love the short story, but, you know, I feel like I've got to evolve in what I do. I don't want to always be doing the same thing with my writing, you know, for fear of getting stale. So, yes, my heart will always be with the short story, but, again, it's also not an easy way to make a living, unless you're Alice Munro, but no one is. So.
Well, it took her a while to get there too.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
What was the first story you ever wrote? I don't mean the first one you published.
Oh, gosh. Now you're really asking something.
Will you tell us about it, though? A lot of people, I think, would not want to.
Gosh, I'm actually trying to remember what it was. I mean, as a kid, I would before bed, I would rewrite the stories that I had heard that evening. I think there was probably a Mills and Boonish story I wrote in my teens.
No way, that's amazing.
Has not seen the light of
day. Right, right. Was it a full-on bodice ripper?
No, it wasn't. I didn't know enough then. It was more about a ballet dancer and a stalky boyfriend.
Right. So. Stalky boyfriend, yeah. Who knows? So you may just be able to sell that right now.
That's very disturbing.
What with 50 Shades and all, I know I'm very disturbed by the idea, but unfortunately I think it might be possible.
I think you've got to have a few personal standards that you don't cross.
Yes, that's a good plan, yes. I'm sorry I suggested it.
No, that's okay. And I think it's in The Name of the Rose that, you know, Aiko says, wisdom lies in knowing what we can do, but what we should not.
Right.
So I think that's it.
Now, what's this new novella that you've got coming out with Dora.com as well? I saw the gorgeous cover for it just last night.
That is the novelette, Finnegan's Field. I had been sort of chatting to Ellen Datlow, and I'd gotten to the point in my career where she said, if you have anything you would like to send to me, I would read it. And I had been thinking, all the terrible sort of thoughts that go on in a writer's head about children who disappear in Irish mythology, and they go off, under the hill with the fairies. And I had written a short story for an anthology, which was in commemoration of Sheridan Le Fanu's stories. And the story I wrote was called Let the Words Take You, which is about children sort of disappearing, based on Le Fanu's story, The Child Who Went Away with the Fairies. And I realised I hadn't quite finished with that idea. So I wrote about this young girl who had disappeared, had, gone under the hill. And I made it a very Australian setting, which I don't usually do with my fiction. And then one day she came back, but she doesn't come back exactly as she had been. And her mother has to deal with all of those consequences and dig up secrets of what her child's become. So, yeah, so that's what that one is. It's very creepy.
And I look forward to it. That's interesting what you just said, that you don't usually set your work in an Australian setting. Why is that?
I think it's because so much of what I read as a child was European fairy tales and British books and those sorts of stories. And it's one of those things that I personally, for a really long time, never thought that where I lived was particularly exciting. Because books are always set overseas. And eventually someone had asked me for a vampire story for Dead Red Heart, which is a really big Australian vampire anthology from Ticonderoga. And I just got in touch with my inner Australian and, went for the whole thing, the outback and giant mutant possums and muscle cars. And I enjoyed doing it. And when it came time to do Finnegan's Field, I just again had that sense that this was where this story belonged. And there's so many Australians who have Irish ancestry, including myself. And I thought, what do we bring with us? Not just our legends. What if we bring our monsters and our ghosts with us as well? So that's where that came from.
Australia, of course, has its own, very sort of rich indigenous mythology as well. But that's not something you use in your stories.
No. And, those aren't my stories to tell. I'm not of indigenous ancestry. And, we have a lot of talented writers who are doing that. And those are their stories to tell, like Ellen Van Nieuwen and Tara June Winch. And, Anita Heiss as well. And they are, those stories belong, with those writers rather than me as a white girl kind of colonizing a mythology that I have no connection to. Yeah. So I'm unwilling to do that.
I find that interesting and appreciated because a great many writers would sort of, would not feel the same way that you do.
It is a controversy, and it should be, because we do need, I'm a big fan of diverse books, and we do need diverse books, and we don't come to diversity by white folks, constantly writing people of color characters. We need to be having those books written by people of color authors. So N.K. Jemisin and Nady Orekafor, who are just incredible writers, and people should be reading them more.
All right, so I believe you two are a Kate Bush fan.
I am.
So am I, a huge one. So I had to ask you, what's the one song you've probably listened to the most?
I think it is probably Running Up That Hill.
Oh,
which
I know.
Is weird, but that's because when Hounds of Love came out, I was at university for the first time. It was my undergraduate degree, and I just found there was something about the sounds and the rhythm of that album that put me in a different place, and I found it really easy to study and write my assignments to. So that was what I used to study to and write my assignments to, and that was like my soundtrack for that one. But I, you know, my heart does belong to Wuthering Heights. I think many of us.
Yeah, many writers say that. I think most, a lot of writers would pick that. Yeah, it's weird that you say that because I mean, I will obviously listen. Everyone who enjoys Kate Bush will not go weeks sort of without picking out one song or the other to listen to. And each time I play, as you said, Running Up the Hill that you were able to study to, I just get caught up in the song and I can't do what I'm supposed to do. Because it's one of those songs like a good book that you reread or you re-listen to, and each time you discover some little nuance, no matter how many times. Or maybe it's a nuance you already knew and you just appreciate it more.
Absolutely. And there, you know, there's a song on that album called Waking the Witch, which is, you know, about drowning and being lost and being lost to your family as well. And I think that's another one of those things that probably enriches my writing a lot without me being particularly conscious of it. But, you know, talking about it now and thinking back to that, that is definitely one of those songs that is very evocative.
Yeah. Well, she's a great writer for fairy tales and fairy tale motifs. I mean, you've got The Red Shoes as well, which I always find incredible and can listen to again and again. It's so haunting, you know. It's oddly enough, my daughter loves it, and I'm like, that's so scary. Why do you? You know, she's 7.5. Should she really be singing The Red Shoes? But speaking of witches and music, I have to bring up Stevie Nicks. Are you a fan of Stevie Nicks as well?
I am. You know, the old hippie skirts and everything. And it was the only American Horror Story I have ever watched is Coven, and I was a bit, you know, doubtful of seeing, you know, having her appear in that because it just
but amazing, right?
She was amazing. I had to eat my words afterwards. But there was a lot wrong with the series, but she was fantastic. Yeah. She was absolutely a highlight for me.
Why do you think there was a lot wrong with that series? I quite enjoyed that season. I loved all the women. I mean, there were bits and pieces that were, you know, dodgy and strange. But overall, I thought it was a really solid cast, and I thought it was really interesting in a lot of ways.
I think it was the end that irritated me mostly, that you had, you did have an incredible cast. You had Angela Bassett, who was just amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
And Jessica Lange and you know, and the young witches were fantastic as well. But we sort of got to the end and it felt like they didn't know what to do with them. So they fell back on these ideas of hell that have been, you know, witches being punished. And there weren't really many people there who deserved to be punished.
Yeah, true.
In this kind of Christian, very typical kind of Christian idea of punishment and hell for witches. And I just thought, you've done such amazing work pulling this away from, you know, traditional ideas and traditional biases, and then you just go back and do that. And that was the thing that irritated me the most.
Yeah. It was a bit of a crutch, you're right.
Yeah.
But of course, then Stevie Nicks sits down at the piano and plays Rihanna, and it's the closest I'm ever going to get to seeing her do it live, and I forgive everything then.
Well, she's pretty witchy and very enchanting, so.
Yeah, I was like, that's enough. I don't care what happens next. You're all forgiven. You got Stevie Nicks to come and be this great white witch. It was amazing. All right, so Angela, what's next for you? What are you up to in the next few months?
I am trying desperately to finish the first draft of Corpse Light, which is the sequel to Vigil. I am editing another novella called The Briar Book of the Dead. And I am off to World Fantasy on the 3rd of November. So, and a few days in New York as well. So with any luck, I'll be giving a reading at the Kill Bar on the 4th of November with my friend Lisa Hannett, who I also frequently collaborate with on collections. And then off to Saratoga Springs for the World Fantasy Convention, and then back to New York for a few days. And basically, we've never been there before, so we'll probably just go museum crazy at the Met and the Guggenheim.
Oh, it'll be fantastic, I'm sure. And you must, of course, go to the tour offices and tell everyone I said hello.
Yes, I will. Yeah. So we've already organized that. We'll be going and visiting and sticky beaking around, but that'll be really good.
I hope we speak again when the next book is out.
That'll be great. Thank you so much, Mavesh.
You're very welcome. Thank you.